Hi everyone. My name is Erica and I am a compulsive overeater. So I want to first thank all of the trusted servants in this meeting for giving me a chance to tell my story today and also creating a place for all of us to get together and share recovery. What I share is my own experience today. I don't speak for OA and I don't speak for this group. So I hope something that I share today is going to help you, but my story is one among many. So if you don't hear what you need to, please keep coming back until you do. So I came into the rooms on January 4th, 2021. At that time, I was about 45 years old and I weighed about 325 pounds. So by that time, I had stopped weighing myself, but I was wearing about a size 24 in the ladies for North America, and that was getting tight. At that time, it was January and I had just been on my annual festive binge. Although in the passing years, it had felt less festive and more insane as the years went on. But at that time, I was trying to convince myself to get back on the wagon, although I hadn't decided which wagon I was going to get back on yet. I had tried most of them by then. I have gained and lost hundreds of pounds in my lifetime. But at that time, I was bigger than I had ever been before. And that morning when I woke up, I was literally cycling through the diets, trying to decide which one to start. And I was tired. I was so tired. I was tired of waking up that way. I was tired of crying. I was tired of failing. I was tired of feeling like I had to sort of suit up in emotional armor every time I left the house because I was obese and the world was treating me the way that it treats obese people. I was also really miserable with the physical manifestations of my disease. I wasn't able to move around a lot without experiencing physical pain and doing damage to my body that I could actually feel happening, even just going up and down my stairs. I was starting to experience mobility problems because of my weight, but almost worse than my size was that sort of really deep sense of shame that I felt. It seemed like the borders of my body, it was almost like being in a science fiction movie, but it was my life. The borders of my body were shifting around almost daily, and there was a new bit sticking out over here and over there. And whenever I saw my reflection, I had a chance to sort of marvel again at how I didn't recognize myself. I was so big, and I had sort of gotten the shame and revulsion at myself. And if you've lived in an obese body or you've felt the physical manifestations of this illness, you know what that's like. You know the indignity of living that way. And I have been living that way for a while. So I am strictly a compulsive overeater. I don't have experience with the other ways that our disease can show up. For me, it was always about more. I've been an avid lover of food all my life. I remember when I was a kid and it was time to eat, it would just make me so happy. I'd be, yay, eating makes me happy. And I remember it being sort of a happiness that kind of took over my whole body. My mom reports that I would chew and dance in my chair when I was a kid. So at the start, food was just kind of a really nice thing for me. It was almost sort of like an absolute good. And I remember really early on that I couldn't get enough of food. It was just this thing that I always wanted. And it was a thing that was usually available. So in my mind, that was great. It started becoming really comforting that I could get food whenever I needed to feel happy. One of my huge moments of clarity, though, in this program was when somebody told me that the disease is progressive. And the first real progression that I can point to with my disease is that it went very quickly from making me happy to making me fixated. And that happened even when I was a kid. So I've spent a really long time, a great deal of my life, in the constant state of feeling that no matter how much there was, it wasn't going to be enough. The portions were always too small. Before you even gave me a piece, the piece you gave me was not big enough. And I learned really fast that I was always taking more than my share, and people got mad at me for it. And it was kind of like they didn't understand this kind of ravenous emptiness I felt. And it was a physical feeling. I remember that very clearly. It was also a mental thing. Like this was triggering almost a survival urge in me. But I learned really quickly that that wasn't okay, that my idea of what I wanted was not okay. It wasn't the same as other people's idea of what I should be having. I took too much. I ate too much. I weighed too much. I even took bites that were too big. So this led to me pretty early on sneaking food. I also have a history of stealing food. And just in general, I have experience from a really young age of food being more important than pretty much anything else. The only satisfaction I got was when there was a lot of food and it was all for me and nobody was going to be monitoring how much I had, which is a situation that's pretty rare for a kid to be in. So as I got older, the disease really progressed with me. And any more agency I took on as a kid and as a young adult was really reflected with food. As soon as I was old enough, I learned how to cook and to bake so that I could be in control of what I was having and how much of it I was having. It was like I got this extra license to have more food. And when I got my first job, it just meant that I could eat more fast food because it was my money and my parents couldn't say anything because, it was my money. But it wasn't really about the money, it was about the food. I did have some awareness that other people didn't see food the way I did, even though I was not at that time cluing into the fact that it was a serious problem. But I think what I learned to do without even really being conscious of it was that I learned to read the room and to mask. So exactly how much can I get away with here and pretend it's enough? How long do I have to be in public before I can be alone with the food and let the mask flip? I didn't even realize I was doing that, but I was absolutely doing that. So this is the other way that my disease progressed and started to really influence the way that I was living my life. As I got older and I got more control of my life, I did a lot to create some safe spaces where I wouldn't have to mask the way I was with food. Like when I was in my early 20s, I lived alone, even when I could barely afford it. And a big part of that was so that I'd be able to sort of quote unquote be myself in my own space and not be judged for my relationship with food. It was also one of the ways in which that isolation that the disease brings with it really started to take hold for me. And so a lot of years before I knew what it was, the disease was really at work in my mind and in my life. I never associated the isolation that came from creating those safe spaces around food directly with being a compulsive overeater until I got to this program. I always just knew that I wasn't like other people and that other people didn't feel safe to be my authentic self around. And of course, there were some exceptions to this. I had a few friends. I got married to a guy who happens to be a former chef, and he sort of understands what my relationship with food was about. But as I look back, I see that food really became a vector for feelings for me. If I was celebrating something, choosing the celebratory food was like the most important thing I needed to do. And if I was sad, it was all about choosing the comfort food. And I got almost really ritualistic about it. So food became part of my way of loving people too. I'm still working on that. If I liked you or I wanted to make you feel special, I'd make your favorite dish, or I'd always make sure I got you a treat when I was at the store. And if I was angry with you, I would eat at you. So I would eat to console myself after a tough day or reward myself after I did something hard. And all the while I was trying to what I could to keep my weight under control, but I was having varying levels of success. Of course, I tried all the things that you've probably tried. Pay and weigh diets, self-help books, fasting, going vegetarian, eating like a cave person, you name it, it didn't work for me. But what I realize now is that the obsession was never relieved by diet. So even when I was successfully dieting, food was always the focus. The chattering monkey never stopped. So it was either about what I was eating or what I was not eating, but there was no serenity and no peace from the food. And I do realize that one of the reasons that diets don't work for me is because I don't have a food problem that gets in the way of living. I have a living problem that shows up in my food. So no diet could help me when the food was always more important than anything else. Food was more important than the So food was more important than acting in my own best interests. It came before showing up for my family or my friends. It came before maintaining any sort of a professional image, making good financial decisions. I would spend my last dollar on food. I went into debt for food. And all the time I did more damage and I got more isolated. But here's the thing. I can't tell you when it happened, but food stopped working. It slowly stopped making me happy. It even stopped bringing me any sort of numbness. I think that was around my mid-30s, but that's kind of a guess. So it just stopped working, and it took me a really long time to notice that it wasn't working anymore, because by then it was just such an ingrained habit. But the whole time I was getting deeper and deeper into the stuff that you experience as a compulsive overeater, I felt out of control. I ate against my will. I modeled some really awful food behaviors for my son. I focused all my social occasions around food, and the isolation just got more and more important. Not because it made me feel better, but because it seemed like it was the only thing that I could cope with at that point. My disease progressed to the point where the isolation from other people wasn't a need, it wasn't a nice to have. I basically had no capacity to manage outside of that isolation for any long period of time. Life was too much. And I think they call that the jumping off point in the big book. Can't live with it or without it. And the time I spent there in that place is also described, I think, really well in the 12 and 12. So it says, quote, Our lives became unmanageable when the car wouldn't start, the computer broke down, or our bank accounts wouldn't balance. We suffered from other people's unmanaged lives or from bad luck. What alternative did we have? We ate to escape the fears, the anxieties, the angers, the disappointments. We ate to escape the pressure of our problems or the boredom of everyday life. We procrastinated, we hid, and we ate. End quote. So that last sentence is basically my eating career in a nutshell. And being in that state really left me totally incapable of showing up for anybody in my life, even when I truly wanted to. So this kind of brings me to a night that I think about as one of my bottoms. And this was a moment when the isolation that I had been pursuing consciously or unconsciously for so long really made itself felt. So I was going out to meet some old friends. I had a friend who had moved away from our town and she was back visiting. So what tended to happen is that everybody would get together when she was in town. So all of these were people that I had known in some way since I was about 14 years old. And by this time, I was about 43. So these people I have known for almost 30 years in some cases. So we were all going out to the pub. I was dieting, so I couldn't eat. I had stopped drinking, so I couldn't drink. And worst of all, I had no sense of connection to these people because I was so locked into my own suffering and misery by this point. But everybody was getting together, and it would have been weird if I didn't go. And I had done that thing that you might have done, where you're sitting on the edge of the bed, looking at your closet, going, nothing fits. I'm looking for something to wear. I don't even want to look nice. I just want to blend into the background and look like a normal person. But there was nothing. So you're thinking, okay, I'm just going to cancel. I'm going to tell them I'm not feeling well. Nope, I did that last time. No, I can't do that again. I went through that cycle about 100 times before I finally got dressed and I went. And everything felt horrible. Everything, seeing people, hearing how their lives were going, knowing I was failing in so many ways, I couldn't stop comparing myself whenever they said anything. And this was a really low point. The illness had me. And any sense of connection that was happening between these people felt like it stopped about a foot in front of me. I couldn't feel it. All I could feel was the misery of being where I was and who I was. And it was awful. And even after that, it took me a few more years of experience those feelings on a greater to lesser degree to come to OA. But finally, that cycle and that misery and that unmanageability broke me. The morning I came to my first OA meeting, it was the end of my Christmas vacation. I had to go back to work and none of my clothes fit again. So I'd been looking at diets as the answer, but that morning something in me broke. And I knew that even if it meant my disease killed me, I was never going to go on another diet. So that got me desperate enough to come to a meeting. And that desperation got me started. I went to a meeting that morning. I knew OA was a God thing. I didn't understand it particularly well, but I had the knowledge that there was a God element to this. And at that time, I was a really committed member of the debating society. I was an atheist, but I was also completely beaten by this thing. So the morning I came to my first meeting, I just closed my eyes and said, okay, God, if you are a thing, help me. And the response that I got was this really clear voice that I had never heard before saying, hand this over to me and let me help you. And I started getting help. And my first few days of abstinence, I just sort of asked that voice, what should I eat? And I followed the direction, and that seemed to work. And I got the idea that I should go to 90 meetings in 90 days. So I did that, and it seemed to work. And in the meetings, I heard a lot of people saying they had to stop eating sugar. So I thought, okay, I'll try that too, and it worked. And I also looked at the suggested plans in the OA pamphlet, and I picked a plan that seemed the sanest, and I followed that, and it worked too. So slowly, I just started doing things that I heard had worked for other people and keeping what worked for me. And I started writing every morning just to process how I was feeling. And I started being as honest as I could in meetings, and that worked too. And slowly, very slowly, the chattering monkey in my brain that told me to eat things out of the garbage got a little bit quieter. And when those things came up and the chattering monkey started up again, I asked the voice what to do. And I carved out time at the end of the day to meditate, and that worked too. So when they talk about telling your story, they tell you to talk about what it was like and what's changed. So that's what it was like. What has changed? The most important thing that has changed is that now I am not in charge of what I put in my mouth ever. I still check in with the voice when I have a meal or a beverage. I now call the voice HP, so that's changed too. I also don't feel the obsession with food the way I used to. The way I describe it now is that there are things that are my food and there are things that are not. And the things that are not go kind of into the same category as cutlery and napkins. Like they're around when food is around, but they're not edible for me. I also don't test the limits of my abstinence. I still treat myself like an addict every day because that's exactly what I am. I know my recovery is a miracle, and I don't know if there's another miracle coming my way. So I'm not going to bank on that. I can also tell you what's not changed, because that's actually really telling. First of all, the world has not changed. I am still surrounded by restaurants that have a drive-through. I'm still surrounded everywhere by opportunities to overeat and reasons to overeat. I still have the same family, the same husband, the same kid, the same job, the same house, and I feel completely different about all of them. They haven't changed, but I have. People still do all the things that used to make me eat. What's different now is that when something disturbs me, I work it through the steps, and that helps me get to the root of the actual issue instead of driving me to this temporary symptom relief that I used to get from food. I've done a lot of growing up, and I still have more to do. I'm working on my relationship with my body. I'm working on my relationship with aging. I just turned 50 this year, which feels really weird because I'm only 30. I feel like I'm sort of being sucker punched by the aging process. I'm working on that. I have to bring that to my higher power. I think the key thing that's changed is that I'm not trying to manage life on my own anymore. I have a higher power and I have a fellowship. And when the food starts to talk to me, I take it as a sign that there's something that needs a bit of step work. And I'm usually amazed by what I find when I do it. I can't tell you what my higher power is. It would not stand up to any sort of scrutiny or discussion. I just know that something is there that has better ideas than I do. And thank God, because my ideas are not always. And if I listen to that voice, things get better. I've also noticed that my higher power has way different standards than I do. I think they sum it up in the 12 and 12 by saying something like the solution is kinder to me than the disease ever was. And that is true for me. My higher power solutions are always rooted in realism and balance and empathy. And that empathy is for me and other people. And there's no way for me to access that without my higher power and the fellowship. Repetition and habit are really huge for me in recovery. I've noticed my recovery progresses in inches and not feet, or centimeters, not meters, depending on where you're from. But I often have to go over the same thing multiple times, and each time something new comes up. And I'll be honest with you, I don't always love that. Yet again, I have to do some step work on my parents. But if that's what needs to be done for healing, then I do that. That's the answer. So my recovery routine is that I start my day with Voices of Recovery for today, and I do some writing to help me process the previous day and set some goals for the day ahead. And in the evening, I set aside about 30 minutes before bed to do a 10th step and some meditation and more writing if I need to. I meet with a sponsor once a week or more if I need it. I have two sponsees. I work the steps to the best of my ability. I have so much to learn about how to work the steps more effectively. I am for sure a work in progress. What it's like now, I've given away about 125 pounds since joining the program. I don't say I've lost them because I know exactly where to find them again. I don't eat sugar or fried food and a few other specific food items, and I don't miss them at all. Nobody's more surprised by that than I am. I still need to be careful of how I'm eating because the urge to just shovel it in or eat like the food police are coming is still very much a thing. So I have to keep my eye on that. I don't feel paralyzed by my disease anymore, though. Physically or psychologically, and I feel like I can look people in the face. And I'm even learning how to connect again. About a year ago, one of the friends that was at that fateful night at the pub came to town, and I got a chance to see her and be present and just be with a friend. We went to a diner, I ate absently, and I got to connect with her like a human being. And that is a miracle. I've experienced a lot of small miracles like that since I came to OA, and that's why I love being in recovery. I feel like recovery has given me back the gift of myself. The self that's beneath all of the behaviors that are driven by addiction and pain. I discovered a me that I actually quite like. I discovered a higher power who has a love and a patience I can't seem to exhaust, and boy, do I try sometimes. And this fellowship has given me back a love for people. And I have a mug that says, "You people." I'm one of those people. But I lost my love for people. But I got it back when I don't focus on the shortcomings of myself and the people around me. I love that who I am today is enough, and who I am tomorrow could be different. Each day I can be more healed, I can be less chaotic, more open and loving and ready to receive love. My body's over 100 pounds lighter. I'm more physically able than I was 4 years ago, and that's a miracle. So I love the learning and the healing that happens here. And I love that there's no limit to it. One of the things that used to really terrify me about my disease was that it seemed like there was basically no upper limit to me gaining weight. Theoretically, it could go on until my body gave out. There was no upper limit. There was no ceiling. And I feel like recovery has kind of flipped that idea on its head a bit for me. The potential here for healing and growth are boundless if I keep working my program. So for that reason, I'm going to keep coming back. Thanks everybody for letting me share my story with you. And with that, I will pass.